This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. You're listening to Place to Be Nation's Extra Point with knowledgeable analysts and exclusive special guests. It's your look at the world of sports through the eyes of Place to Be Nation. And now your hosts, Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, George Ribellino.
And welcome to episode 11 of Place to Be Nation Extra Point. I'm your host, George Ribellino, along with my co-host, Scott Criscolo. And, you know, we got a lot to talk about today. And today, when we're
recording me, or are you just going to roll for
said Scott Criscolo.
You just said my name. I usually say hi to you at least.
Hello.
Hello.
Are you there? Anyway.
Why don't you just sit in the gold room with your champagne and let me introduce you like you always do, okay?
Well, I usually like that, but I want to do something different today.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode 11.
Yes, episode 11, and you know, we got a lot to talk about today. I mean, it's the 75th induction ceremony for the National Baseball Hall of Fame. We got a little basketball, a little hoops to talk about. You know, good old LeBron going back to the Cleveland Cavaliers. It's this time of the year that I love. You know, the baseball trade deadline now is coming up.
Yeah, this week.
And it's just one thing, I just love this time of the year because you get a little bit of that football starts getting added in there, the training camps. Really, really getting juiced up right now. I think things are really starting to come around because, you know, for those people that are big baseball fans, now they can get a little juiced because now they can start talking about the NFL season. You can start getting ready a little NBA, off-season news. So it gets everybody's, you know, it's a little something for everyone. You know, now the World Cup stuff is over. You know, once the U.S. was out and, you know, Italy, I was done with it anyway. But other people get into it for various reasons, depending on what their nationalities were.
We've been on since they have. So congratulations, by the way, to Germany, who did win the World Cup. They beat Argentina. We were on our cruise. That's why we haven't been on in 3 weeks.
We belong to the German club here. Yes. There's not like 1 ounce
don't
of German.
We're about as German as German gets, aren't we?
Exactly. It's Criscolo and Ribellino. That works, right?
Exactly.
But anyway, you know, we really, you know, what I really would love to delve into is the Hall of Fame. I mean, today was as we're recording this, a big day. You know, 6 Hall of Famers, one of the best classes we've had in a long time. And, you know, this should be a day that baseball's celebrating. But then, you know, you pick up the paper or you pick up, you know, you look, pick up the paper. I'm sounding old school.
Kicking old school there.
Yeah. You know, you searching the web and all of a sudden you come up and you see Tony La Russa saying an idiotic thing like he thinks that the PED users should be in the Hall of Fame with an asterisk next to your name. Why would you even want to bring that crap up when you know it's going to cause all kinds of stuff? It should be a day that baseball celebrating, celebrating your accomplishments as well as the accomplishments of the 5 other candidates that are going in. And you just cause stir up stuff. I mean, sometimes that guy doesn't think.
Yeah, no,
I'm not a big Tony La Russa fan.
I was never really a big fan of his either, but is he
a good manager? Yes. You know, a lot of people, you know, kind of blame him for the way the bullpens are used these days. And, you know, yeah, he was innovative with that kind of stuff. But, you know, I think also, you know, part of the reason why bullpens are used the way they are, especially since the mid-90s, is, I mean, I think the PED use does have something to do with it.
Right.
Because you have, you know, balls flying out of the ballpark and, you know, obviously starters don't last long and, you know, you got to get to your bullpens. I mean, I think you also have the advent of guys being more patient at the plate, taking a lot of pitches. You know, the Yankees and the Red Sox are big teams doing that. But going back to La Russa, I mean, do you really need to say something like that on a great, you know, on the eve of a great day that's supposed to be happening for the game of baseball?
Right.
You know, sometimes I don't know. And he works for Major League Baseball. It's like, shut the hell up.
I know. No kidding.
Shut your and you're a lawyer. You know, you have a law degree. Yeah. How
Tony La Russa has a law degree?
Yes, he does.
Hmm. Well, if I ever go into the chair, maybe I should get him as my defense.
Yeah,
attorney.
Don't call
But
before
but
we
anyway,
continue, let's oh, go ahead.
I think you know, I'm just really excited about it. I mean, you got a great class going in. You got three of the greatest managers of all time going into that you know went into the Hall of Fame today. You have you know, probably the greatest pitcher of our generation in Greg Maddux going in. Tom Glavine, one of the better pitchers of the generation, and one of the greatest hitters of our generation, and did it the right way. Frank Thomas, the Big Hurt.
Mm. Yeah, no, exactly. To give you a little skinny on the rest of the show in our next segment, even though it's very baseball, you know, very baseball friendly day today, we are going to talk some hoops. So in our next segment, we'll be joined by the Bengal of the Bayou, the master of hoops, Mr. Andrew Reich. He'll talk about LeBron going to the Cavs, Melo. We'll talk some coaching stuff and some other hoop tidbits. And then later on in the show, we'll be joined by my brother, Place to Be Nation basketball analyst, Chris Criscolo. But we'll talk more about Hall of Fame. You know, my brother's a little older. So he remembers guys from the 80s, even to the 70s. So we'll talk about...
You love saying that, don't you?
What, that he's older than me? Of course I do.
Yeah.
Because I'm tired of being the oldest one. Actually, wait, you're older than me, too. So there's a lot of people on this show that are older than me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What? So anyway, we'll talk about Hall of Fame. And the big announcement I want to talk about right now, before we get to a couple of things, is we have our email address, extrapoint@placetobenation.com, and continue to go to it if you're, you know, if you have a thought of or something and you're at your computer and you want to shoot us a line, please do, extrapoint@placetobenation.com. But it is official. We finally have our Extra Point Twitter. So follow us at P2B, Extra Point. P2B, Extra Point. And shoot us some tweets. Tweet the doctor. I never thought I'd hear me say that.
That's right, baby.
Tweet the doctor and tweet me and tweet the show.
P2, as in the number two, like Derek Jeter, you know.
P2B, Extra Point. So we have a couple of tweets, actually. We do have an email. We do have a second email that I meant to read on our last show that we didn't get a chance to. It's John, and he writes, "Guys, I love your show. I am a diehard Red Sox fan. Dr. G, please listen to this email. Do you think Pedro Martinez is a first ballot Hall of Famer?" Okay, fair enough question. We'll talk about Pedro with my brother later on in the show. And I've said this a long time. I think Pedro Martinez, if you take away, and I'm sorry, if you carve out the you know, the whole game three of what freaking year was it? 2003. 2003 and the shoving of Zimmer and all that jazz.
You can't take that away. You can't judge him about on that.
No.
Zimmer
what has he ever done? I mean, yeah, he was a little aloof. He was kind of a, you know, he's kind of a flake, but proof's in the numbers.
It shouldn't take away from what he did on the field. I mean, listen, I'm a Yankees fan, but I also respect the game. You know, he's had some great years. You know, 1999 had a phenomenal year.
Yep.
And won the Cy Young. You know, one of the greatest years, you know, top 20, you know, seasons for a pitcher of all time. Yeah, I would say he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. There's probably going to be no doubt there. But you never know with these writers. But yeah, I would put Pedro in. No issues on my yeah. part there.
Okay. And so thank you, John, for that email. Now we have a couple of tweets, and the Twitter handle went up yesterday. We're taping on Sunday night. The Twitter handle fired off on Saturday afternoon. We have a couple of tweets. Let's see, at Steve J. Rogers Jr. Isn't this the guy who said that that Brooklyn food sucked? Do you really?
Oh, because he got mad because I said about Manhattan food. Listen, Manhattan. Get me wrong. There's great food there. I mean, compared to some of these other second cities around the country. But Brooklyn by far has the best food of any of the boroughs.
Anyway,
sorry.
He says, He tweets us, maybe the Mets need Triple H for GM or owner, hashtag best for business.
Wow.
Well, I would wholeheartedly open that that dialogue.
Duh.
Because then we'd be the adapt or perish.
Oh my god.
That's evolution.
The Church of Triple H over here.
Church of Triple H, that's right. Fall in love.
Oh man, I don't know what we're gonna do.
Your guy retired 11 years ago. Nobody cares. All right.
But no, the Mets, please come on.
Please come on. Why are they in the league? Why do they share your air with?
No, actually, the Mets have been playing a lot better.
They won today. Hey, look, let me tell you something. 10-game road trip to start the second half of the season, and they went 5-5. I'll take that any day.
Yeah, I mean, their pitching. Their pitching is going to be the strength of this team in from years to come. They have a lot of young guys on the horizon. I think they have a much better outlook for the future than the Yankees do. I mean, they have a lot of talent. You know, there's a lot of trade rumors going out there. I know that you and I were talking off the air about you know, possibly with Tulowitzki and Gonzalez for the Rockies, maybe possibly even getting both. I'm hearing, you know, that might be a tough one. I don't know if I think they're going to want too much. I don't know if the Mets are going to want to go that far, but I could see the Mets getting one of them at least. You know, obviously Tulowitzki will help that shortstop problem. Problem with Tulowitzki is he's got a big contract. He is very injury prone. I thought about he would be a perfect candidate to replace Derek Jeter, especially he wears number two in Colorado because that's his favorite player. But, you know, as a Yankee fan, do I want another guy that's injury prone? It just seems like all these big contracts and these guys are injury prone. But I think for the Mets that really need to start showing their fans that they're committed and adding the pieces that might help, you know, the young guys mixed with some veterans might not be a bad move. Obviously, getting both would really, really upgrade. I mean, you would make the Mets, you know, possibly even a chance to even get really. I mean, they're kind of in the playoff race now, but really, you know, make a move if they got those two guys.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, I mean, obviously the Mets have a surplus of pitching in the minors. They have Syndergaard, they have Montero. Montero pitched a few games earlier this season. Mixed results. Looked good in some starts and others. I don't know if Syndergaard will even come up this year. The window pass, not window pass, but it would have been in June-ish. I don't know if it'll happen now. They need a big bat. You know that Matt Harvey's back next year, and the staff will be great. With Wheeler and I don't know if Dylan G or Jonathan.
You know, you got to give Harvey a chance. I mean, you know, he's going to come back probably. I wouldn't think he'd be ready for the beginning of the season, but maybe a month or two into the season.
Right.
But you don't know what you know when you're off that long. How if he's going to come back
right
away, being the Matt Harvey of old, but. But I, you know, if the surgery truly is successful, I mean, he is had a great mind for pitching before, so that's not going to go away. I could still see him being, really good, top flight major league pitcher, but you know, there's always that question mark.
Exactly. So, Steve, thanks for the tweet. And, Chatty151 tweeted us, Dr. G. Ranking of Braves pitching staff from the mid-90s in baseball history. Well, of course, two of those guys went in today in Cooperstown. Of course, Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine. John Smoltz is eligible next season, and I'm sure he'll next year. And I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, you had Glavine, Smoltz, Maddux, and don't forget you have Steve Avery.
We'll expound on the stats statistically with my brother later on in the show. And don't forget, they had Denny Nagel at times, and they had a few guys in that 4 and 5 slots. Kevin Millwood.
Mike Bielecki.
He was good. Mick, he was a dual guy, right? He came out of the bullpen, too.
Yep. In terms of those three guys, I mean, you could put them up. You could stack them up against anyone. Those, you know, great Orioles teams. You know, even some of the great Yankee teams, in the 90s, even in the past, in the 40s and the 50s, because these guys played, especially those three, played many years together. So they had that consistency. Now, they didn't win as many World Series as you thought they would because they did their jobs, and sometimes the bullpen didn't do their jobs, or their hitting didn't hit in the clutch.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the bullpen, I mean, overall pitching staffs, no, I don't think that the, you know, I think the bullpen was a weak link for them. But if you want to stack starting pitching against all time, you know, those three guys, I would say you got to put them right up there at the top. I mean, you know, right there, you know, top two or three, you know,
staffs,
I guess, if you want to, you know, yeah. Say.
Now, the funny thing staffs. Is, if you look at World Series champions over the last 25 years, let's go back to the early 90s. Let's go to those, like, we'll even say the 91 Twins. We'll start back for them. We won't go to the 80s because the 80s was much more pitching dominated. You didn't have the kind of numbers you have now. Although, I would put my 86 Mets staff against anybody. Bob Ojeda, Doc Gooden, Ron Darling, Sid Fernandez. I mean, those guys were awesome. Yeah, we had two guys with 20 saves. Davey Johnson did a hell of a job with that staff that year. But let's start with, like, the 91 Twins had, what, Jack Morris. And that was pretty much it. I mean, the rest of the staff was good, not great. Frank Viola had already, I don't know if he was on that staff. No, he already went to the Mets, I think, at that point. Those Toronto Blue Jay teams, I mean, they had Al Leiter, they had Dave Steeb, they had Dave Stewart, Jimmy Key. I mean, good pitching, but not like this pitching.
This generation, I would definitely say no problem with saying that they're the top.
Yeah. But why they only win one ring? Was it that bullpen? Was it that bad?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was the bullpen. I think, you know, sometimes lack of clutch hitting.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things. But and you look at the Yankee dynasty. I mean, your pitching staffs were good. You had some really good pitchers, but you didn't have the numbers that these guys put up. I mean,
no, a lot of these guys stepped up in the postseason. But that was
the minute the calendar went to October 1st, that's when the David Cones, the David Wells, and particularly Andy Pettit, that's when those guys, and Roger and Clemens, you know, even though he wasn't, he had some help. Those guys stepped up when the lights shined brightest. That's what I think that's what the Mets were hoping in 2000 when they got Mike Hampton. They thought when the clock, and he got them to the World Series, and then the one start he had, game two, he laid a stinker. But when you look at just statistically, that Maddox, Glavin, Smoltz, that three-headed beast, can't be compared. Sadly, they only won one.
It would have been interesting to see that pitching staff and say, you know, during the 90s in that American League East. See how they would have stacked.
For the American League in general, I mean, the West was. I mean, the Oakland lineups were badass. The Angels had a big lineup. Obviously, the Mariners. Look at the Mariner lineups in the late 90s. They were
the Indians.
Cleveland and Texas were probably. Now we're just talking statistically, not teams. Obviously, the Yankees were the best overall teams in those years, but just statistically, probably the two best lineups, top to bottom, were probably Cleveland and Texas.
Those were
the teams that racked up 1,000 runs. Then of course they faced the Yankees and right in the stinker. Not
I always say good pitching will be good hitting.
Well, it's like defenses win Super Bowls, centers and point guards win NBA championships, not guys that score 40 a game, and goaltending wins Stanley Cups.
Exactly.
Bruins would not have won the Stanley Cup without Tim Thomas. Devils would not have won three cups without Marty Brodeur. Devils scored a goal a game half the time. And, you know, Steel Curtain. You know, the Steeler offense was pretty good in the 70s, but it was the Steel Curtain. Same thing with Doomsday. Look at the 86 Giants. Phil Simms, that offense was efficient, but that was all about that defense.
Exactly.
And the same thing with World Series teams. Pitching, closers. That's the thing. The Yankee, using the Yankees as an example postseason is very difficult because you had one guy nobody else did, and that was number 42.
That's right.
You could have a guy struggle or pitch okay till you get to the eighth and ninth inning.
You felt if you were down.
The minute you hear Kirk Hammett's.
Well, in the bullpen in general, once you got to the sixth or seventh inning and you were down, they had the teams defeated.
Yep.
The teams were let down. They felt like they had control, and it was in the other team's head. So, yes, it's, you know, in all sports, you know, defense is really, you know, your defense has to be very strong, and that's what ultimately will help you win championships.
Yep. And we'll talk about that with my brother Chris later on in the show about, like, the kind of manager Joe Torre was, you know. And, of course, we're talking about Maddox and Glavin, also Frank Thomas, the Big Hurt, got into the Hall today. One of my favorite players in the 90s, and sadly never won a ring. Closest he came, I guess, was, what, 93, when the White Sox won the Central, or actually technically it was still the West, and then they lost to the Blue Jays in the ALCS. I think he made the postseason a couple times with Oakland, I think. And then, of course, three managers, and that is Bobby Cox, Joe Torre, and Tony La Russa, all with rings. You know, good, great teams that they managed. So they went in the Hall, 75th year of the Hall of Fame. So kudos to Cooperstown, and you and I have been there many times. If you've never been to Cooperstown, you need to go.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like today it was the third largest attendance at a Hall of Fame induction, 48,000.
Wow.
I think 2007 when Ripken went in, Ripken and Gwynn, that was 75,000.
I wonder how many went in 99 when they had that three, when they had Brett, Nolan Ryan, and
Yount. Brett, that's right. Brett and
That class.
Yeah, that was the second. They had 50.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. So more people. So, well, I mean, Oriole fans travel well.
It should be interesting to see
in 4 years.
And I was surprised even with Torrey that it did wind up being a little bit more than that. But it would be interesting to see when Mariano and Jeter go in back year.
Yeah, I agree.
But you know, I just love this weekend. I think it's a great weekend.
Too.
It was after having really no regular inductees on the ballot go in last year. It was great to have all these guys this year and to be able to celebrate the game for what it is. And I think, you know, you had six great choices.
Yeah, I agree. We got a lot more to talk about, but we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Andrew Reich. We'll talk a little NBA free agency. We'll talk about LeBron going to the Cavs, Melo, and a whole lot more. So the Bengal of the Bayou, the guy who steals everyone's oxygen. Coming up next. Make it real, or else forget about it.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today, plus be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right. The Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Welcome back to this episode of PTBN's Extra Point. I'm Scott Piscola with the Doctor, George Replino. Don't forget, I pumped it up during segment one. Keep it up. We have our new Twitter handle, @P2B. We've got a couple of tweets already. And it's only been up, a day and a half as of right now. So keep the tweets coming. We got two to talk about later. And we talked about them, of course, on the first segment as well. But it's time for me to stop talking because this guy loves to. One of my favorite people, the Bengal of the Bayou, a consistent contributor to PlaceToBeNation.com. Of course, one of my regular compadres on the main event, and he's been on here a lot as well. And he's been waiting for an outfit, a platform, to talk about 23 or 6. And now we're going to get the chance. Mr. Andrew Reich.
Well, there's no debate now because he already announced on Twitter which ones he's going to wear. So
yes.
It's going to be back to the old school, Flight 23.
He's going to wear 23. I think he should, too.
Yeah, I think the – you know, somebody said a joke. You ever seen the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Parts of it. It's been on, like, HBO here and there. Yeah. I've never seen the whole thing, though.
It's a phenomenal movie, but basically the story is that he a guy goes through a bad breakup, and he gets this machine done on him where he can kind of relive his dreams when everything was good. And I feel like that's what's going on with Cleveland. Like, every bad thing that LeBron did, like changing his number and leaving Cleveland and all of that is, like, unbroken. And now we can go back to the way it was, almost like dandelions and, you know, running through the street.
Happy life, yeah, yay, and lollipops and gummy bears. And
Like all those people in the opening to the Drew Carey show when they're singing Cleveland Rocks. That's yes. What they're like now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well,
it's funny.
Considering the rest of the sports teams. Well, I shouldn't say that. The Indians are actually having a good year. The Browns are going to suck again. But I don't know. Maybe there is.
They got Johnny, my man.
Well, that's true. Maybe there is a revival in Cleveland. I mean, the Indians are having a good year. They're a little bit behind the Tigers, but they're chasing the wild card.
Urban Meyer's got Ohio State back on track.
Back on track. They're a top five favorite this year.
And their arrest record is up, which is always a good thing if you're trying to win in college football.
Well, yes, of course. And the Browns have Johnny Mann if he doesn't, you know, get caught drinking underage with freshman girls.
Was anybody really surprised that he went back to Cleveland? I'm not. I feared he was going to go win a couple of rings and go back home. I think that was his plan all along.
I was surprised, Doctor. The thing with it is that I think he was surprised himself at the end of the finals of how much Wade and Bosch have kind of tailed off, and then when he realized what he was going to be stuck with, along with the amount of cap space that they were going to take up, given that they weren't going to be able to get any fish for any more free agents, which they didn't while he was waiting to make his decision. I think that made it easier for him to leave, but I was still surprised that he left for Miami, that he left Miami to go to Cleveland. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, let's put it this way. And on the last show, I did say that I thought he was going to stay in Miami because it looked that way. But what I was saying is that I remember talking about this in the past, not before we even had a show, like that he was going to go to Miami and then eventually he'd have some kind of homecoming back in Cleveland. I think he didn't like the way it ended there, even though there was a lot of hurt feelings. But I think, you know, he truly does love his hometown, but he just felt like the team wasn't going where he wanted to go. The problem I had with LeBron and all this last time around was the whole hoopla thing, ESPN special. Then he goes to Greenwich, Connecticut, of all places, at the Boys and Girls Club to announce, you know, so he had New York fans thinking he was going to New York. It was just such a mess. That's what I got upset about.
He was definitely much less mature. Four years ago, you know, much less mature. So 5 years
ago,
I guess.
And I don't think it was a coincidence that he spurned ESPN for the announcement this time and worked with direct rivals, which is Sports Illustrated, to make the decision. Because I think even though LeBron and his handlers were very instrumental in the decision, I think ESPN kind of like was nudging was needling it a little bit, saying, well, let's try to make this bigger than just a regular thing. Let's make it a big primetime thing. And
right.
It got bigger and bigger and bigger until everybody watched, like, about like 7 or 8 million watched it. And it was such bad press. And I think Doctor hit a good point in that the decision, while such an awful, you know, kind of cataclysmic mistake, turned out to be one of the reasons why LeBron went back, because he realized, even though he won championships in Miami and he still probably would have been able to had he been able to get another good supporting cast to surround him, he realized, I have unfinished business in Cleveland. I wronged them, and I have to make it right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's just a sob story that he's doing just for the sake of gaining popularity. I really think he truly feels that way, and that he really wants to go back to Cleveland and make it better.
I agree. And, you can't even say his last decision was about money. I mean, I guess you can't really blame the guy. You can't really blame the guy for wanting to win. The problem is, I think what people had a problem with, like what I mentioned before, was the way he went about the decision. It was such hoopla. And you know what? You can say all you want about ESPN needling him, all that stuff. You know what? He is LeBron James. He's in charge of LeBron James. You could have all the handlers you want, but in the end, it's your decision. It's, you know, either, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's you have personal responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, and in the end, he could say, you know what? No, this is not what I want to do. This is going to make me look bad. I want to go to Miami, but I'm just going to announce my decision, and that's it. And let's just make it. This whole hoopla thing did not need to happen, and that's where he rubbed people the wrong way. Hey, people in Cleveland were going to be pissed no matter what if he didn't do it that way or not.
Well, that was the thing about it when I was telling people, well, if he goes back to Miami, for Cleveland to feel like they were deprived would have been a little weird, because I didn't feel like LeBron was really, really letting him on that he was coming back. He never said anything in the offseason concerning the agency, because Pat Riley put a gag order on him. He said, look, please. Well, I don't know if it's Pat Riley or the general management or LeBron himself, but I think they all realized together, look, we can't make a big issue out of this. We need to wait until the offseason when all the finals and the playoffs is over, so that this doesn't just take over the chit chat when we're trying to win a championship. Once it was over, then it was the ball was in Pat Riley's court. He kind of called out LeBron in the press conference, and I got a feeling that LeBron didn't take it well, because all of a sudden he was telling Pat Riley after he opted out, okay, it's your turn to get guys. And in the first week, they didn't get Kyle Lowry, they didn't get Luol Deng, they didn't get Pau Gasol. The best they could really muster up with that cap space that they were going to be expecting was Josh McRoberts and a broken-down Danny Granger. And no disrespect to those two guys, but that's not a good catch if you're trying to win an NBA championship, especially considering how badly broken down Dwayne Wade is now, and the fact that Chris Bosh at max money, probably in about 2 or 3 years, is one of the worst contracts in the NBA. So LeBron's looking at that thinking, oh, man, I don't know if I can make this work in about 2 or 3 years. I'm probably just better off going back to Cleveland with younger guys.
Well, he looked 4 years ago when he left Cleveland, you know, that last year, 2009-2010, they had nothing in the cupboard. And in 4 years, I mean, Kyrie Irving has stepped up as an amazing young point guard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've made some moves within the organization. They've gotten rid of some dead weight.
They have a lot of draft picks, yep, and they also have assets to get Kevin Love.
And they have Andrew Wiggins, who may end up being a Timberwolf. We'll see. I got to be honest with you. If I'm the Cavs, do they really need Kevin Love? I don't know. I think they could win without him.
Defense? Oh, yeah. Are you asking if with just the cast that they have now?
Just with the cast they have now. I think a core of LeBron, Kyrie Irving, and Andrew Wiggins. The East sucks now. I mean, think about it.
The East.
The Bulls are still broken. Mm-hmm. The Knicks are, well, the Knicks. Dr. G's Nets, I mean, they're in tough shape right now. I mean, Paul Pierce is gone. He went to the Wizards. I don't know what the future of Brooklyn holds right now. I like, we'll talk about Jason Kidd in a minute, Reach, because I know you haven't had a chance to let her rip. And you know, Dr. G now has a hobby of ripping Jason Kidd, who's a two-faced prick.
Well, you're right about that. You know, it's weird because, you know, we just came off of a Super Bowl where the AFC, you know, Denver kind of ran right through it. And then you get to the Super Bowl and you're like, oh, okay, now it's getting a little bit harder, mm-hmm. you know. And I think the Eastern Conference has gotten to the same point where, you know, the team on top, and then all the teams below them, like Indiana and Brooklyn and all these teams, not so great. And I think we're at a point with the Eastern Conference where they haven't picked up the pace yet, no pun intended. So Indiana has got to do it themselves, and I don't think they made the right moves this offseason that really scare people into thinking that they're going to be that much better. In Chicago, I don't feel like they got that much better, to be completely honest with you. In Washington, mm-hmm. it was probably the one team that really made a decent move. And I don't know if they're good enough to win an Eastern Conference title. I think just with what they have with Kyrie, with Andrew Wiggins, with Deion Waiters, with Anderson Varejao, I think they can win the Eastern Conference. When you put LeBron James onto your team, you're putting the best player on the planet Earth on your team. Mm-hmm. And that changes everything. That makes your defense better. It makes your offense efficiency better. It puts your assist rate up. Your transition game is fabulous because he can run. Everything goes up in terms of basketball play, mm-hmm. except for rebounding when you have LeBron James. That's the one thing where Kevin Love can really help them, true. Is that he can be the top rebounder, whereas LeBron was the top rebounder in Miami, and that was too much pressure on him because Miami wound up being the worst rebounding team in the league for the last 2 years, and it got to him once they got to the finals.
Yeah,
it's going to be amazing to see that city just be transformed. The Reno will be packed again, and you'll see nobody going to Miami again. You know.
Well, you know, you say that, you know, we were talking about bandwagon fans last time, and I think there are a lot of them that are jumping off, but I don't think Miami is a bad team. I think that with Luol Deng, because they added Luol Deng after they lost LeBron, I think that team, as constituted, is still about a 40 to 45 win team, but like the Nets last year, I don't see them going any farther than the second round, and then they're done. So. Yeah.
But I agree. LeBron's gonna, you know, it's gonna be exciting to see. You kind of feel bad for a city like Cleveland. Listen, I'm not a LeBron fan, but it'll be kind of fun to see, you know, that city get excited again, and he'll put that team back on the map again. And I think he made the right decision. I just, you know, I like I said, I think. He was going to be hated in Cleveland no matter what with the last decision, but he made himself a national hated guy by doing it the way he did. So I think, you know, he kind of is making up for it, and you're starting to see people coming around to him a little bit more now.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree.
And I'm going to say this to Scott too, because we were just talking in the beginning about how he's going back to the number 23 in Cleveland. So that gives you the feeling of like, oh, we're just going to get the same LeBron we got in Cleveland. And I want to give fair warning there that when you look at these highlights of him as a Cav, and – what you got to understand is LeBron in 2014, 2015 is a far different player in terms of not just in terms of personality and maturity and all that stuff. In terms of style of play, he's a lot different now. And Scott can really help me out with this in that when Michael went back to the Bulls after retiring, even though he still had the ups, he still had the game, he still had the mental focus, he was different. You know, he had the fadeaway jump shot. He was defensively, he was more adept. He just had that better sixth sense of how to pace the game. He didn't waste his energy all the time. Michael, when he won his three titles at the end of the 90s in Chicago, was different from the Michael that won in the early 90s. Well, I think we're going to see the same thing with LeBron, more post play, more of that wanting to pass it off to the next guy, not trying to do too much, kind of like he did in Miami at times. I think you're going to see a different LeBron than you saw in Cleveland when he was trying to do it all by himself.
I'll tell you, this is what it's called. It's called energy displacement. Mm-hmm. The first three Pete Michael had, he faced three aging franchises. Look, I was on cloud nine in the 1991 Western Conference Finals when the Lakers stunned a pretty good Portland team in the mm-hmm. West Finals. And then in game one, Sam Perkins hits that three at the top of the key. And I'm like, holy crap, six titles. Yeah, six people.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Well, Michael missed it at the buzzer at the end.
And then Michael
did the move in game two. And then
and then three straight ugly games in the
fourth. Well, I wouldn't call game three ugly.
They went to overtime in that one.
But after the overtime game, it got hideous.
It got hideous. But Michael was more athletic, and he was a younger player. And he had a different style of play. He had a more
emotional.
He had an older, more experienced front court with Cartwright, and he had a more experienced bench. 92, aging guard in Clyde Drexler, aging team in Portland. 93, remember 93, they didn't even have the home court in that series against Phoenix.
No, I always felt like 93 was their toughest opponent.
Yeah, that Suns team was badass. I loved that Suns team, actually.
The thing about the Suns that doomed them against the Bulls is that the Bulls played defense and the Suns didn't.
No. Now, the second three-peat, Michael was a little older. He knew he couldn't be doing crazy dunks and stuff because he wasn't young anymore. He had a younger team around him, so he had to be a little bit different of a role player. Plus, he was facing much tougher competition. As much as I hated them as a team, those two Utah Jazz teams were damn good.
Oh, my God. And there's a reason why they were the only one that they've had to play twice.
And you know, let me tell you something. A lot of respect needs to go to that 95-96 Seattle Supersonics team. They were not
I was about to say that. Yeah.
By any stretch. Remember, well, they were down 3-0. They could have rolled over and folded up like a cheap suit.
Yeah.
And they won two in a row. And then game six, they finally.
And they had to take out the Jazz in seven games. And they had to sweep the defending champion Rockets in the round before that.
Yeah.
I mean, they were a 64. So. They were about a 64-18 team. And the Bulls took care of them. And the Bulls also had to get by the Magic, who had won 60 games.
Yep.
So they played some tough opponents.
Right. The premise of this is LeBron is in the same situation. He's older. Now, mind you, his NBA career started much earlier than Michael's. Now, if Michael skipped Carolina and started his career at 18, well, who knows what would have happened? You know, look at Kobe. Kobe is the same age as most guys in the league, but he appears to be older, even though he really isn't, because he's been playing so much.
Look at Kevin Garnett.
Yeah.
I mean,
because these guys, you know, started their careers very young. They got to the NBA.
They went to the playoffs every year.
Every year. Kobe was averaging, 80 games a season. I mean, I'm sorry, 80 games. Almost 100 games a season.
About 100, 109, 105.
Yeah, I mean, look at 2002. I mean, they had like a couple of seven-game series. They had that great series that they beat Sacramento, which wasn't fixed. And, on a quick side note, I compare the 2002 Kings to the 1986 Red Sox. Everybody pisses and moans about the Donaghy game. And I was on a cruise ship watching that game six. The Donaghy game, and they rigged it, and all this other bullshit. They still had to win game seven. They were at home. And you know what they shot in that overtime? 1-for-12. So suck it, Maloof brothers, okay?
Yeah.
Same with the 86 Red Sox.
There's just a different level of stress and anxiety that goes into the late moments like that. And for the Kings, they just kind of cracked. And I remember one where Doug Christie took a three, and it was early in the shot clock, and he bricked it so badly. And I knew, they're done.
And meanwhile, Stojakovic is throwing air balls. He's hitting the side of the backboard. I mean, that's not Tim Donahue's fault. But anyway, that's a totally different topic. Anyway, our point is, as you were saying, Reish, is that you know, LeBron now has to kind of displace his energy through four quarters and play a little differently. And Wiggins is the guy that's going to be doing all the is going to be if he's on this team. If they don't, they're probably going to end up trading him if they do get Kevin Love. But Wiggins is the kind of guy that can eat up the rebounds. He's not a tall guy. He's a 3-4.
Very skinny.
You know who would have been a great draft pick? You might think I'm nuts, I'm happy that we drafted him. I think the Cavs would have loved Julius Randle.
I would have loved Julius Randle going to the Pelicans if they had a
that's true, too. But Julius Randle on the Cavs might have not been – I mean, look, Wiggins is not chopped liver. I'm not saying that. But if they had in the back of their minds at the time that they were not going to go after Kevin Love, Julius Randle would have been a great pick for that team.
I'm going to tell you this. I think Wiggins was an insurance policy for them just in case they weren't going to be able to get LeBron. And now that they have, they're sort of in a cavalcade where – all right, now what do we do? Do we play him together? Because Wiggins at guard would be a bad fit because he can't shoot yet. I don't know. I think they can still make it work, though, because if they wanted to play at guard or maybe have LeBron play strong forward, like a power forward, and Wiggins like slips in at the three, I think you can make it work. But I think going big, like with Embiid or somebody like that, may have been able to fit better for him.
Yeah. All right, let's switch gears. Let's talk about Melo. Because this gives the doctor a chance to rip the Knicks, which is another one of his favorite hobbies.
I don't have a lot of ripping of the Knicks to do this year.
What,
I thought it'd be good moves.
What's to rip? They stink. What is your look? And I love Phil. Dr. G's not a big Phil guy either, but he's staying. I have faith in Derek Fisher. I'm a fish guy, big time. You know that, Reish. I think that with the change in coaching philosophy, in all seriousness, I know I'm making fun of the Knicks just for Dr. G's benefit, but I think the Knicks will be a little bit better, but they have traded a boatload of chips. They have no center now. I mean, Tyson Chandler's gone.
I don't think they're going to be better than they were last year. I think they'll be
equal. They weren't very good last year either.
Exactly. I think they dumped a lot of guys just to get the contracts off their back, like Tyson Chandler's and Raymond Felton. But
it is a transition year, I think.
I think what it is that they convinced Carmelo to stay and trust in Phil that he can get the right parts together for 2015 and 2016 when there's a big time amount of free agency, big time free agents coming out, including Kevin Durant. So I think they're holding out hope that they're going to be able to put it together because they still have the contracts of Amari Stoudemire and Andrea Bargnani that combined take up about $35 million, which is just abysmal. So they got to get those off the books in 2015, and then you start cleaning up and start picking up some big names.
Why do you think Melo would have decided to stay for what is a transition situation? He must have some faith, and Phil must have zen. They must have had like candles and – and you know, plum wine or something in his office or something. I don't know what kind of mojo did to bring him back, because why would Melo want to come back to a transition situation?
Number one, for the money. You on the max level.
The Bulls weren't going to give him the same amount or more.
The Bulls couldn't give him the same amount.
No, they couldn't.
He was going to pass up not only on that extra year that the Knicks were going to be able to offer as the original team,
right,
but the salary, I think, depletes by about a good two to four million per year. So instead of signing a 4-year, $88 million deal, he was able to sign something to the degree of like a 5-year, $120 million deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with right. perks, with whatever perks he wants to add, including I think Carmelo may have gotten a no trade clause in the new contract too. So everything worked out there. Number one, the money. Number two, I think he realized that if he goes to Chicago, he's going to have to change his style of play to fit Thibodeau. If he wanted to go to the Rockets, he would have had to do the same. And I think he just realized, I'm just better off trying to win by myself here in New York and trust Phil. And Phil may have had a come to Jesus moment a little bit with Melo to convince him to stay, because it looked a little dicey for the first month of free agency. But sooner or later, once LeBron made his decision, I think Carmelo came around and said, I'm going to try to do this by myself too.
Let's switch gears to the draft quickly. One draft move, and we talked about it a little bit before we went on the air, Rish. It was almost a foregone conclusion for me that Marcus Smart was going to go to the Lakers. They wanted it. They needed a point guard. They needed a playmaker in the backcourt to help Kobe out. Instead, one pick before, the Celtics take Marcus Smart, which means the Lakers end up taking Julius Randle, which I have no problems with. I love Randle. Saw him live in Brooklyn, chew up Providence's front court. Sorry, Justin. And now, does this mean that at some point halfway through this coming season, the Celtics finally trade Rondo?
Oh, yeah. I thought they were going to trade Rondo that day.
That's kind of what I thought, too.
But the waters weren't hot enough, and I think the fact that he still has that money on his contract. And I think Rondo's would be able to make probably a little bit more money on the open market. I think he makes something to the level of like 10 or 12 million.
Right.
I think he'll probably get a little bit or more in the next deal, but he's coming off the ACL. He's still a terrible shooter. And no one knows where his mindset really is when it comes to where he wants to play. Cause he's such a quiet guy. So I don't know if people really had an idea of what he wanted to do. So I think it was a little calm after the Kings. I think the Kings were one of the ones trying to get him. And once they dropped out, I think it became obvious that Rondo's going to stay at least until the deadline in February, the trade deadline. And then we'll see what happens. What team gets desperate enough to give away a couple players to try to win in the playoffs. And then Rondo walks in free agency in 2015. But no, I thought that was a foregone conclusion. And then when Smart went to the Lakers, it was obvious they were going to need size because Pau Gasol was going to leave. And so Randle was the next best guy, and they took Randle. So it made perfect sense to me.
I think it's dope. You know, it's funny. The Lakers have all this. You know, it really makes me mad. The Lakers has all this cap space now. A lot of contracts. They did get Carlos Boozer, which is all right. I'm not earth shattered by it, but it's
yeah,
okay.
it's a borrowed pick. It's okay.
Yeah, nothing crazy. You know, but the fact that the Lakers pretty much had Chris Paul 2 years ago, had him, took him away, made him go to the Clippers, and now, because of that crazy racist lunatic Donald Sterling, the whole team may sit the year out.
I don't believe any of
I
that.
I don't believe any of that either. I think that's a bunch of horses.
No, I think that's like worst case scenario stuff by Adam Silver and people in the NBA to try to scare the court into not giving the team back to Sterling. That's right. It's all PR.
Yeah,
but also, I got to mention for the Celtics, they also got a very nice player in James Young out of Kentucky who played with Randle. So you got Young and Smart to play with Jeff Green and Avery Bradley, who re-signed, and Kelly Olynyk. So they got a few pieces in place.
Love Jeff Green. Always a big Jeff Green.
Well, I love Brad Stevens. I think he's one of the smartest guys in the room.
What about the Doctor's Nets?
I'd give him a C. You lost Paul Pierce, and I'm not saying Paul Pierce was like their end-all, be-all. He barely showed up in the regular season as it was. But in the playoffs, he played well. His defense was terrible, but he was still a good leader for them down the stretch of games. Mm-hmm. Kevin Garnett, I'm sorry, guys, is fucking finished. I was watching him at the end of that playoff series with Miami, and it was obvious that
he's done. He could have one good game, and then you need to give him 2 days off.
It's kaput, yeah. And their draft picks, they didn't have any, so they had to buy their way back in because they knew they weren't going to be able to re-sign Sean Livingston. So they had to get a lot of people on the cheap on their cap space. So, well, they don't have any cap space. The problem is they're so far over on the luxury tax that you can't add anybody in. You can't bring anybody in. All you can do is give them away. Mm-hmm. So they took people on non-guaranteed second-round deals like Markel Brown and Xavier Thames, who might not even make the team. And you took on Jared Jack, who I think is grossly overpaid. Yeah. And the one thing that they have – well, actually, I'll say two. They have Mason Plumlee, who played well, and he'll play alongside Brook Lopez, who's coming from off of an injury. And also, Mirza Teletovic played well, so you could put him in at the small forward spot. And then you got the Jason Kidd thing, and hell broke loose there. I absolutely hated what Kidd did. I thought what he did was trashy, and I thought it was against coaching etiquette by all degrees, trying to get a job somewhere else when there's somebody else there, and the general manager doesn't even know it. And so they made a decent pick with Lionel Hollins. The problem is with Lionel Hollins, I don't know if what he wants to do fits best with what the Nets have in place, because they have a lot of guards. They have a lot of guys that want to play finesse. They don't have a lot of tough guys. They need guys that are physical and aren't afraid to get nasty in the paint. Mm-hmm. That's how Lionel Hollins liked to do it in Memphis. And I don't know if this team fits that equation. So I think this year coming up is going to be a little bit of a rough one for Brooklyn.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we'll see how Lionel Hollins' frustration gets with this team, because he likes tough guys, and he really doesn't have it right now.
They called it grit and grind.
Yeah, I like Lionel Hollins, actually. I love what he did in Phoenix. I did love what he did in Memphis. He's an X and O guy. He's a guy that just wants a job. He doesn't want any extra office gunk. He just wants to coach. Those are the guys you love.
Why can't coaches just stick to coaching? It's getting ridiculous. You're
thank
a coach.
You, with you a capital paid. T and a capital Y. Jesus.
You know,
this autonomy deal with the coaches where Stan Van Gundy, well, I'll go back to coaching, but I want to be the president. And then I'll hire my best buddy, Jeff Bauer, to run the team just as like a patsy. And Doc Rivers did the same thing with Kevin Eastman. Kevin Eastman is his assistant. He's his towel boy. And he went and he moved to president of operations for the Clippers. So basically every move goes through Doc. I'm not saying Doc's a bad guy. I'm just saying there's a reason why you are a coach. And if you want to be a GM like Phil Jackson wanted to be Phil Jackson is the greatest coach in modern sports. He never got a shot while he was coaching a team as a general manager. And I'm not saying it's because Phil wasn't capable. It's just the culture. Coaches just don't get that kind of power. They don't get that kind of monarchy put to their feet. And for Jason Kidd to get that after one fucking year of coaching a team that barely went over 500 is stupid to me. But
I used to stick up for him. I don't stick up for him anymore. I mean, he just has a way about him. I mean, he comes off in the press like he's a nice guy and all that. But
he threw Lawrence Frank under the bus, you know. And some people say that Lawrence Frank had it coming to him, but the end of the day, Jason Kidd needed coaches around him to help him coach. And he got a couple, like, I think one of the guys, his last name, I think, was Prunty. And he went with him to Milwaukee. So he's still going to be learning on the fly in Milwaukee, but he's definitely ain't going to no playoffs with them. So he's going to have to learn on his own how to win. You know, he's not going to have it set, you know, set before him. All right, we have some talent here. Now you got to win. Now you got some guys like Jabari Parker, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Brandon Knight, Zaza Pachulia, guys who don't really know how to win. So if he's that good, if he's a guy that the new owners from Milwaukee are going to really fish out and fire Larry Drew incognito to get this guy, Jason Kidd, then you better fucking prove it.
It's definitely because he's friends with the new owner, and anybody that's working above him is going to have to watch out for the knife going in their back, because
exactly.
He ultimately is going to wind up being president of the team. He didn't go over there to coach. I mean, that's not what he wanted in Brooklyn. He wanted more. So what makes you think that he's just going to go there and be, you know, quiet, good old Jason Kidd, and I won't say nothing, and I'm going to, you know, just coach this horrendous Bucks team.
The fascination with Jason Kidd and Derek Fisher is that they're so closely tied to the players because they've only retired recently, so they're considered players, quote-unquote, players' coaches, and that's fine. But guess what happens when you start getting this dual power in the front office? Now, all of a sudden, and Jason Kidd's going to learn this, you're not a players' coach anymore. You're right. The enemy. You're the guy that the guaranteed contracted players don't really want to trust anymore because you're not giving them playing time because you're making the decisions and you're trying to rule it with an iron fist. Like Stan Van Gundy's deal still confounds me because I thought he was a good coach in Orlando, but I don't think he got thrown under the bus as much as he kind of put the knife in his own back. Mm. And this guy got basically autonomy in Detroit to run the team and coach the team. And judging by the signings that they did, guys like Jody Meeks and Caron Butler, and I don't think they're going to be going anywhere next year either.
You know, the Cavaliers, I just was doing some researching, Reish, before we let you go. You know, it would be a great guy to put, you know, in the middle to grab rebounds for the Cavs? Hmm. Rusev.
Maybe they could get Lana as a cheerleader.
Lana could be a cheerleader. We can have Vladimir Putin.
I had a feeling that Scott was going to get some wrestling.
I always get wrestling because I don't get to talk about it with him on the main event because I don't do any of the talking. So, Andrew Reish, pleasure as always, brother. I will. I'll talk to you
Did you figure out a LeBron James wrestling comparison?
Honky Tonk Man.
Hogan when he came back in 2002. Oh. And everybody loved him all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. But he should have actually, his first game as a Cav, he should have come out in his Heat jersey. Like, you know, the Hogan came, was still NWO before he came back, and then ripped the jersey off, and then out comes Wiggins and Kyrie Irving could be the Rock, and
yeah,
you know.
Because I think LeBron had the same moment Hogan did at WrestleMania where he comes out in the Sky Dome and they're like, he's trying to be bad and he's realizing, wait, they love me again. And I think LeBron kind of had that moment in Miami. He's like, wait, they love me again. So if I go back to Cleveland, people will love me all over again. And I think that was kind of his mindset.
Yeah.
The NWO is dead. The Miami NWO is dead.
Miami NWO is dead. kind of like the middle of 2002 when
it's
died.
Black, it's the black and white one. It's just Wade and Bosch. And
it's just, yeah.
Luol Deng. Luol Deng is like Scott Norton.
Oh, God.
And what's Shabazz Napier? Vincent? No,
Shabazz Napier is the Great Muta.
Is the Great Muta? Okay, yeah. Reish, pleasure as always. I will talk to you next week
on all right.
Our next main event. When we come back, Big Brother's going to join us. My brother, Chris, to talk hoops again and a little golf. And, of course, today was, as we mentioned in segment one, the inductions into the Baseball Hall of Fame. That and more coming up next.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcast? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans are wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans are wrestling off.
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for a show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Bob. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week you can join Marcus Vanderberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on PlaceToBeNation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Welcome back to Place to Be Nation's Extra Points. I am Scott Criscolo with the doctor, Dr. G, George Bellino. Joining us now, continuing with our evening of superb basketball analysts, we just, of course, had Andrew Rishon, another guy who knows his hoops. He will probably go to either Bob Stores or Modell's to get his Shabazz Napier Heat jersey. And right now, actively looking for maybe a closer for his baseball team. He is an active contributor. He joins us, of course, intermittently on Place to Be Podcast. Of course, he's always on our March Madness preview, and we'll have him back on extensively in the fall when we get close to the start of the college basketball season. My big brother, Chris Criscolo. Welcome back.
What's going on, folks?
Now, let's start with the first thing. Will you get your Shabazz Napier Heat jersey?
The answer to that question is no.
How do you think the Hornets feel? I was stoked. I would love to have gotten a Shabazz Hornets jersey. That I would have done. And then they make that trade, and they're going to suck. So I think it's pretty bummed. What did you think about him getting drafted by the Hornets? Were you excited?
Well, I don't think that they really needed him. I mean, it was obvious that Pat Riley wanted to get Napier because he knew that, you know, LeBron had said he wanted him. So I think it was an effort to say, look, you know, the Heat haven't had a real point guard. I mean, Mario Chalmers isn't a point guard. They really don't have one. And I think this was an opportunity to get a true one, you know, somebody who they felt could come in and contribute. But unfortunately for LeBron, it wasn't enough to keep him. But I didn't think he was going to stay with the Hornets. I would have been surprised, actually, that they picked another point guard. I mean, they've got Walker, and I don't know why they would need another one. But I won't be buying a Heat jersey. In fact, I just picked up my Spurs 5 championship jersey, by the way.
Ah. Do you think they repeat?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think you could say that they're going to repeat. The West is so stacked. I mean, any one of six teams could win the West next year. The East is a joke. The West is loaded. To think that they could is unlikely.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think so. But Chris, are you still on the Knicks bandwagon at all? Or no, you done with them?
I haven't been on the Knicks bandwagon since Isaiah Thomas got involved in that franchise. Which, you know, and since that, forget it. I mean, and they're even worse now. But I haven't been a Knicks fan since the days of Patrick Ewing and Charles Oakley and the rest of that.
Low-scoring, high-fouling.
Low-scoring, thuggery.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Spear by Oakley. Today, of course, was the 70. Do you realize this, Chris? 75th induction ceremony for the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I saw that they everybody was wearing patches today.
Yes.
I thought that was pretty good how they did that.
Yep. For those listening, if you've never been to Cooperstown, it is a trip you must make. Absolutely
yes.
Must make. There's no doubt about it. Of course, these two guys will be waiting 4 years. You got these guys. You guys have a choice of back-to-back years. You can go in 4 years for Mariano, or you can go in 5 years for Derek Jeter, or you can go to both. Speaking of this year's class, it's good to have someone on who's a little older who remembers the 80s and the 70s, because we got a tweet earlier from Chatty151, our good friend Chad Campbell, who wanted to talk about, and we talked a little bit about it in segment one, the doctor and I, about that mid-90s Braves pitching staff. Tom Glavine, John Smoltz, Greg Maddux. I mean, that staff was maybe the greatest pitching staff of the last, like, 35 years, 40 years. I don't think there's any team. I mean, the 86 Mets had a great staff. Doc and Bobby Ojeda and Darling and Sid Fernandez. But a lot of the teams, if you think about it, in that won World Championships in the 90s and the 2000s, they didn't have an awesome pitching staff. Maybe those late 2000, the early in this decade Giants, you know, Kane and Lincecum. But there was never, even the Yankee dynasty, your guys' pitching staff was good. They weren't awesome like the Braves pitching staff, but the thing that made the Yankee pitching staff great is the minute the calendar hit October 1st, that's when the David Cones and the David Wells and the Pettits showed their best. What are your thoughts on that great mid-90s Braves pitching staff?
Well, I mean, as far as their starting pitching goes, it was probably, you know, I mean, you could even throw Steve Avery in there for the one or two years that he was part of that staff. But, you know, Smoltz, Glavine, and Maddux are, you know, they're three Hall of Famers. It's unfortunate that they didn't, you know, I mean, they had the 96 series wrapped up. I mean, and they couldn't close it out. But the problem wasn't the starting pitching. It was the bullpen that killed it. You know, Mark Wohlers was...
he was never the same after that pitch.
No, he wasn't. But, no, that staff was fantastic, but their bullpen is what let them down. And if you're going to talk about a pitching staff, I don't think you can not say that the bullpen is, you know, overall that staff probably wasn't, you know, as good as the Met staff was or even others. The starting pitching, I think, was as good as any that you'll ever have ever seen and may ever see. But as an overall staff, you'd have to look down on a little bit because their bullpen just gave away too many playoff games that they had in the hand.
Mm-hmm.
No, I agree. I agree. I think as an overall staff, I agree with Chris. I would, you know, there were other teams that were better, including probably the 86 Mets, even the 98 Yankees. But as a starting staff, and especially they were together for many years, I would say you have to make, you know, some of the best of all time.
I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, look at the numbers. And I was saying this about this with a couple of people at work when the announcement was made they were going to the Hall. Maddux in particular. Here's a guy. And next year, first year entrance next year, two other guys that pitched during this era, Randy Johnson and Pedro Martinez. You're talking about the era, quote unquote. We all know, you know, the S word. And, you know, balls flying out of here and jacked up dudes pounding 500-foot home runs. You know, guys had no business, you know, Brady Anderson hit 50 homers. What the hell kind of travesty was that? Although it did help me my fantasy baseball team. But meanwhile, these guys were putting up, you know, 21 wins, 22 wins, ERAs in the 1.8s, 1.9s, 2s. You're talking about, you know, lineups. This American, look, Cleveland Indians of the late 90s, your guys' lineup, the Yankee lineup, the Red Sox lineup. You're talking about lineups that were mashers, Texas Rangers.
I think Pedro Martinez's 1999 season is one of the top 10 starting pitch, you know, line scores for a season for a starting pitcher. I think you've seen in 50 years. I mean, wasn't his ERA like 2.5 and he had 300 strikeouts and his walk to strikeout ratio was like 6-1 or something like that. He was incredible.
I'm gonna go to,
that year.
Well, while you're talking and while we're continuing the conversation, I'm going to go to baseballreference.com, which is a fantastic website.
Now, Chris, do you think do you say Pedro's an easy first ballot Hall of Famer?
Yes, I do. I don't think he's an easy first ballot Hall of Famer, but he's definitely, I think he gets in on the first ballot, but because of his prickliness, might keep him off. But I think he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. You guys disagree?
I absolutely think he does. I think people take apart, you know, and I'm not digging into Yankee fans here, but if you take away the whole Don Zimmer thing or whatever the hell happened in that what did he ever really do wrong as a pitcher? Nothing really. Never hit any well.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff that he did was pretty much against the Yankees. But all right. Here was Pedro's 1999 line score. You ready? He was 23-4 with a 2.07 ERA, 31 games, 29 starts, 5 complete games, 1 shutout, 37 walks, 313 strikeouts, and his whip was .92.
And how many innings?
In 213 and a third.
I mean, that's as good as you're going to get in the middle of the steroid era to have a line score like that in the American League.
He won the Cy Young. He finished second for the MVP. You know, I mean, that's pretty good numbers. And his numbers never got any worse.
Now, is Smoltz up for eligibility next year?
And he's a first ballot for sure.
Yeah, just because, you know, he's kind of like that Eckersley kind of thing. You know, I think he was a better starter than Eckersley was, but and then
there's no doubt about that.
And then obviously he was a pretty good reliever. I mean, had a pretty good stretch there as a closer.
Continuing on with guys that were studs in the steroid era. Now, even though this was a strike year, here was Greg Maddux's 1995 line score. Ready? 209 2/3 innings. He was 19-2 with a 1.63 ERA, 10 complete games, 3 shutouts, 181 strikeouts. You want to know how many walks in 209 innings? 23.
Yeah. How did he not win 20 games?
He won 20 games twice. He was 20-11 with the Cubs in 92, and he was 20-10 with the Braves in 93.
I know, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
He didn't get the run. He didn't get the run support.
He would have won 20 games the strike year, because when the season ended, he was 16-6, and that was in the end of July. He might have won 30 games, right? When did the strike end? I think it was late July, right? It was definitely before August.
What?
What is that noise? Hey, you got your own fanfare. 1994, the strike year. When did the strike?
It was August.
All right.
I think it was August too.
But he had. I mean, we weren't even in September. He already had 16 wins. He might have had like 26 wins.
He would have won 24, 25 games probably that year.
Now 1997, he was 19-4. He in 23 years. How about this? 5,008 innings. He was one walk shy of 1,000. So let's round it. 1,000 walks in 5,000 innings. That's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
That's just beyond comprehension.
His whips were 1.04 in that mid-90s stretch. 1.049, 0.896, 0.811, 0.946, 0.98. You're talking about, again, National League, some pretty mashing lineups in the night. Now, probably the more high-octane offenses were in the American League. You guys, the Red Sox, the Rangers, the White Sox.
It would have been interesting to see if he actually pitched the American League, which was going to bring my next question, because I know you and I, Scott, have talked about it. But what do you think about Mike Mussina? He's a Hall of Fame. I beat him. The era he played in and the division that he pitched in, do you think that he's a Hall of Famer down the line?
What do you think, Chris?
That's tough. I mean, it really is tough. I don't know. I mean, when you start looking at his type, you have to see where he landed on some of the, you know, how close, where was the Cy Young ranks? Did he ever finish second?
Let's see.
I mean, because his stats aren't going to jump off the page yet. What did he win, 250 games?
270 and 153.
270, okay. 270 is a pretty good number. So, I mean, that's...
And 103 losses, that's a pretty good...
He finished fourth in 92, fourth. These are the Cy Young finishes. 1992, fourth. 1994, fourth. 1995, fifth. 1996, fifth. 1997, sixth. 1999, second. 2000, sixth. 2001, fifth. 2008, sixth. So he's always in the top five in the Cy Young.
You know,
19 wins like four times, twice. Well, twice. 18 wins twice. 18 wins three times, actually.
I'm going to have to say that he's a borderline. I think there's a chance that he's going to go quite a few years before he gets in. But I think I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't, and I wouldn't be surprised if he did. But I don't think he's a surefire, and I don't think that he's a guaranteed miss. I think he is one of those guys that's right on the fence.
Yeah, and some people say, listen, if you have to think about it, then he's not a Hall of Famer.
And you know what? That's... And that's a great point. The Hall of Fame should be, if you hear a name, you say yes or no. If you have to think about it a little bit, then I think he's a borderline. And you know, there's plenty of guys who are in the Hall of Fame that we all don't believe belong there. So you have to think he's got a shot. But yes, I agree. I think the Hall of Fame at times gets watered down. And if you can't say yes to somebody when the name pops up, then I think that they shouldn't go in. And
well, you know, I think baseball is the toughest Hall of Fame to get into. I think the football Hall of Fame is very watered down. Same with the basketball Hall of Fame. I mean, yeah, you could say there's some guys, the baseball. I can't say you can name a lot of guys that I think deserve to be there. Not like the other Hall of Fame. So, I it's going to be tough. You're right. I guess if you do have to think about it, the only reason why I say you have to think about it these days is because of the steroid era, that, you know, sometimes you got to look at stats a little differently. That's the only reason why I would say it. If Mike Mussina pitched in the 70s and the 80s, I would say probably not. But like some people trying to say Jack Morris for the Hall of Fame. I don't think Jack Morris is a Hall of Famer. Was he a great postseason pitcher? Yes. But I don't think his stats warrant being in the Hall of Fame.
Well, unfortunately, he played for some horrific Tiger teams. And some very good ones. I mean, he was on the 84 Tiger team, and he was on the 91.
But I think his ERA is even higher than...
Yeah.
His ERA is even higher than... overall, I think than Mussina, and he pitched. I mean, the 80s, you know, it was some decent offensive production going on, but not like it was in the mid 90s.
No. Now, the other guy, of course, the other player that got in today, and then we'll talk about the managers in a minute. The players that got in today, of course, one of my favorite guys ever, non-Met, and that is the Big Hurt. I owned his sneakers, as did you, Dr. G, Frank Thomas. 521 lifetime homers, 1,700 ribbies, won a couple of MVPs.
I think he's in.
Yeah, well, he is. He went in today.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would have. I thought he was in.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you never heard anything about him. You do worry a little bit just because he did play during that era and he was a big guy. But he was never, you know, named on any lists.
Here's an interesting trivia question I want to give you guys. Because I don't know unless you have the stats in front of you. Now, you know he's a power guy. Big brother, what do you think Frank Thomas's lifetime batting average is?
.295.
301.
Yeah, I knew it was right around 300.
I was going to say 299.
That he was a 300 hitter.
That's pretty good for a power guy.
Yeah, it is. And he won a batting title.
He won a batting title. He hit .347 in 1997. He won a batting title.
Yeah,
never knew that.
I don't think there's any doubt that he was a Hall of Famer. He was an automatic in my book.
I agree.
Next year, like we said, I got to look for the Hall of Fame. There's a Hall of Fame section on this website. But next year, I know that Randy Johnson We looked at Pedro's numbers, and Pedro, I think he's in.
I think he's automatic. I don't think there's any question he's not in.
Randy
Johnson, I think, is automatic too.
Yeah. You look at this guy's numbers. This was the one guy I thought had a shot to break Nolan Ryan's 5,714 strikeouts, which would have been pretty ridiculous because I don't think anybody would have ever done that.
He had a rough start to his career. That's probably the only thing that hindered him.
Yeah.
From you know, trying to go for it, and he proved he can't pitch in New York. But that's besides that.
No, a lot of people can't. He was a 300 game winner, which I didn't know he was a 300 game winner.
Yeah.
303 and 166. Final strikeout total, 4,875. He would have had to pitch a lot longer. I mean, he was still, 900 strikeouts shy of...
I still can't. Three things I remember most about Randy Johnson was the perfect game he pitched when I was living in Texas. When he killed that bird in Toronto.
Yes.
And when he almost killed John Kruk in the All-Star game.
Yes. And then Larry Walker batted right-handed.
Those are the three things I remember most about Johnson.
I have to say, though, and I don't know if you disagree with this, I think overall Randy Johnson was a better pitcher than Nolan Ryan.
You got to remember, Ryan played on some hideous...
Some of those Angels teams in the 70s sucked.
And so did the Texas Ranger teams were terrible.
Yeah. Let's bring him up for a minute. I love Nolan Ryan. Nolan Ryan was probably my favorite pitcher, my favorite non-Met in the 80s.
I just remember him beating the crap out of Robin Ventura. That's when
he was giving him the business down there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now Nolan Ryan, I mean, he had a lot his wins and losses were. I mean, if any Met fan owns a Jim Fregosi jersey, he should be shot. But here's a guy who, I mean, he pitched a lot of innings. Let me see how many innings he did pitch. 5,386 innings. That's not a lot, actually. It's about the same as who pitched 5,000 innings. Maddux.
Maddux. Yeah.
Now don't forget.
Remember, he was a reliever at the beginning of his career.
Well, and also don't forget, bullpens were not as prevalent back then. You can figure this, okay? 1973. Look at this. 1973. He was 21-16 for the Angels with a 2.87 ERA. You know how many complete games he had? 26. 26 complete games, back-to-back years.
That's insane.
These were his complete game numbers from 1972 to 1979. Pretty much all his years in California. 20, 26, 26, 10, 21, 22, 14, 17. Then once he signed with the Astros in 1980, only once for the rest of his career did he have more than 10 complete games, and that was in 1982. So he was beaten to death by the Angels in the 70s, and they sucked.
What's Nolan Ryan's record in his ERA?
He was 324 and 292. 292 losses is a lot, but again, you take into account who he pitched with.
I mean, he played for more. I think he pitched for more teams that lost 100 games, I think, than anybody in the history of baseball.
Yeah, I mean, there was some god awful in the Astros. Some of those. I mean, the Astros in the 80s weren't awful. I mean, they almost knocked us out in 86, but they weren't. They were never terrible. They made the postseason a couple times. The Texas teams in the early 90s are pretty lousy, but and he still won double digit games a couple times. 324 and 292. 3.19 ERA, which is pretty good. 5,714 strikeouts in 5,386 innings. So he averaged over a strikeout an inning. Let's see. 222 complete games. That's a lot. 61 shutouts. 3 saves. The last one in 73 with the Angels. So he was even pitching in the bullpen sometimes in the 70s. The Angels just pretty much, you know, buried him. Never won a Cy Young. That's a knock on him. Never won a Cy Young. The closest he ever came, he finished second in 1973. That year I told you when he won 21-16 with 26 complete.
Nah.
No, but back to the point, I agree. I think Johnson is a better pitcher than Nolan Ryan.
I thought it was a little bit... I have to say, I thought that Johnson was much, much better. But, you know, listening to the stats now and Scott going through it, I have to reconsider. But Johnson, you know, again, Nolan Ryan played on some bad teams, so you got to give him, you know, that. But, you know, Randy Johnson was a great postseason pitcher as well as a regular season pitcher. And, you know, he struggled too in the beginning, Randy Johnson. So just imagine if he didn't have those, you know, two or three struggling years, what he would have been overall. But what's Randy Johnson's
record? Let me bring it up for a minute. And then, Chris, because, I want to talk to you about the managers.
Because I think, you know, with Randy, he was a little wild in the beginning, you know. Like I remember him throwing pitches all over the place, even against the Yankees when he first came.
He threw a lot of wild pitches in Seattle in his early years.
But
let's see his final numbers: 303 and 166, 3.29 ERA, 4,135 and a third innings, 4,875 strikeouts, 100 complete games, 37 shutouts, strikeouts per nine innings 10.6. He won 5 Cy Young Awards, including 4 in a row from 1999 to 2002.
Yeah, I think overall. I mean, just because he also, again, pitched in the steroid era. I mean, that's not Nolan Ryan's fault, don't get me wrong. But to still have a 3.29 ERA overall pitching in that kind of era, you got to kind of... I wouldn't say he's like extremely better.
I wouldn't say head shoulders, but if you made me pick, I would say Johnson is better. Is better than Ryan.
Mm-hmm. I gotta go on the website. All right. Well, I'm looking up. I want to look up one other thing, but while we're doing that, 3 managers went in today. Also, as I mentioned earlier in the show, Joe Torre, who these two gentlemen very close fondness for, Bobby Cox and Tony La Russa. We won't bloviate on Torrey too long because I don't need any love fests here. But, Chris, your thoughts on Tony La Russa? I never shrewd guy,
kind of a best game though. Manager I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Tip Kirchen, who's one of my most respected baseball writers, said this about the 3 managers. He said Tony La Russa was the best game manager ever. Bobby Cox was the best players manager ever. And Joe Torre was the best manager of an owner.
What do you mean, best manager of an owner?
Be able to manage his owner because, you know.
Oh, manager of his owner.
Yeah, Bobby Cox, your owner. I mean, we all know how Steinbrenner was, you know, just, you know, he's just nuts. To be able to,
you know what,
manage him properly.
I agree.
And deflect all of any negative. You know, anything negative coming from the owner, he would deflect away from his players and keep it on him so they could just focus on playing baseball.
Remember, early on in this player's career, George was not a big Jeter guy. Not a big Jeter guy, remember those first few years. He thought he was...
I mean, Torre definitely had a way... Again, he managed the owner very well, and I definitely agree with that. But I think, you know, I think Joe Torre... And, you know, I'm actually reading Willie Randolph's book right now. And Willie makes a good point, you know, that, you know, sometimes Joe doesn't get the credit that he deserves. You know, Joe changed that team when he was brought in. He kind of brought that National League kind of ball in 96. He's a much better manager than people give him credit for. You got to remember, after we lost that 2001 World Series, and I'd say that's the downfall of this organization, because Steinbrenner was like, you know what, he was tired of Torre getting all the credit for everything. He's like, now we're going to do it my way. Had to bring in the Giambis and bring in all the big bats and go away from what Torre always liked to be strong up the middle. He always wanted to have, you know, the defense, play small ball, you know, not this, you know, wait for the 3-run homer all the time. When you took him out of his comfort zone, which is what George did, that's when you saw those Yankee teams struggling. Bringing in the Sheffields and the Mondesis and all these jerk offs that did nothing, but you know, run their mouth. But
what about Ron Delicious? We love Ron Delicious.
I don't know, Chris, if you agree with me, but I think Torre is a much better manager than people give him credit for. Is he as strategic as Tony La Russa was? Sometimes he went with the gut more than anything, but he went with the people he trusted because, again, George brought in all these freaking blowhards that did nothing in the 2000s.
My I always thought that Torrey was good at keeping guys. Tino Martinez made a comment once that he was in a horrible slump, and Torrey called him into his office before a game, and Tino thought he was going to bench him or move him down the lineup. And he went in and he sat down and he said, here, he handed him a piece of paper. He said, I want you to go to this restaurant. I heard they got really good, whatever type of dish that Tino likes. And Tino was stunned because he was expecting something totally different. He says, he picked the paper up. He went out that night and had dinner. The next day he came in and he went 3 for 4 and he broke out of his slump. He said he was always able to keep, to know what buttons to push with what player. The only knock I have on Joe Torrey is I thought he was not a good bullpen manager. I thought he overused the Yankee bullpen too much. He was a guy who sometimes he would follow statistics and go lefty-lefty, righty-righty, and then sometimes he would go with his gut. And I think you're either a gut manager with a pitching staff or you're a statistics guy with a pitching staff. And I never liked that he would go back and forth. And he used to bring guys in and out, two batters, and he pulls the guy out. I thought he overused the bullpen if I had any knock on Joe. But, no, I agree. I think he's a much better players manager than he got credit for. In fact, I think a lot of people say that, well, I mean, look at all the talent he had. I could have managed that team. No, you couldn't have.
Exactly. Look at him. I love him to death. He's my favorite player of all time. Look at how Don Mattingly's struggling with that Dodgers team with all those egos. And that's why I think Torrey left the Dodgers when he did it. He goes, you know what? I don't have the magic I had anymore to get these guys. These egos were just not gelling. And unfortunately, Mattingly got stuck with it, and he's struggling with it too. It's not an easy thing to do. And, he definitely had the touch. And, after a while, things sometimes you wear out your welcome. Any of the greatest managers or coaches of all time, that after a while, your magic runs out. It's just,
the stress level gets to you too at a certain point.
Yeah. I like, Joe was saying, I saw in an interview, he goes, we just, we knew, I knew that the end was there. They knew the end was there. We just didn't know how to do it. We didn't know how to say goodbye. And that's why it ended the way it did. And, now there's a lot of controversy going out. I guess he didn't mention George a lot in his speech today. And then he felt bad afterwards. So that's going to get a lot of play in the New York press over the next couple of days. So hopefully that doesn't sour his relationship with
Yankees. Oh, come on. I mean, really?
Yeah. So,
all right. I'm going to give you guys, before we let my brother go, I'm going to give you guys, we could have talked about more sports, Chris, but we'll have you back on later on in the summer. I'm going to give you guys statistics of a player, and I'm not going to tell you who the player is. I just want you to tell me whether or not they belong in the hall. 22 years in the league. He was a .284 hitter, 630 homers, 1,836 RBIs, one MVP award, and multi-time All-Star. He's got a decent amount. 184 stolen bases. He didn't steal as much at the end of his career. Over 1,300 walks, 500 doubles. Would you put this guy in the Hall of Fame?
I'd say yes. I'd be 630 homers. I mean, 1,700 runs batted in.
Dr. G?
Hearing the numbers, yes.
Okay. That's Ken Griffey Jr. His first year is 2016.
He's a first ballot without question. He's going to have 90% of vote.
Do you think it's disappointing? Because a lot of people, here's one guy who pretty much was unscathed during the steroid. He was not in the Mitchell report. He's never been mentioned, and he fell,
tore his ankle up,
100 and something home runs shy. I think going to Cincinnati killed him too.
Yeah,
going back to home and all that jazz. He should have just stayed a Mariner. And he stayed a Mariner his whole career. I think he'd have broken the Barry Bonds record.
The problem is, he played in that mausoleum out in,
the Kingdom. If he had hit in Safeco, if he had stayed and just kept hitting at Safeco, oh my God, he'd have been hitting 50 home runs a year.
Well, no, Safeco's not an easy place to hit home runs at all.
Safeco's not an easy place. That's a pitcher's park.
Look at Cano.
Cano's struggling this year. Cano can't. The power.
He's only got what, 11 homers or something like that?
I don't even know if he has that many.
Hmm. Anyway, he's a first balloter next year too, along with Jim Edmonds. I don't know if Jim Edmonds is a first year.
Jim Edmonds is not a first ballot. I mean, I say that right away.
I don't think he's even
now.
He might. I don't even know if he's a Hall of Famer.
No, I wouldn't.
All right, and one more quickly. Looking ahead to the 2017 potential Hall of Fame ballot. First year guys on that team are, let's see. Any Jorge Posada? Yes. No.
No.
No. Wow. Pretty thin in 2017. Irod, Manny, Vladimir Guerrero.
Too many question marks.
Javi Vasquez.
No.
Tim Wakefield.
No.
I mean, it's funny because I think, at one point I thought maybe Jorge had a shot if he had a couple of more 20-something home run seasons, just because, catcher position, he was one of the top hitting catchers in the game, but no, in the end, he didn't really have the numbers.
Arthur Rhodes is that's his first year on the ballot. I think Arthur Rhodes should have his number retired by the Yankees. Isn't his ERA lifetime against the Yankees like 56?
Oh, we loved hitting him.
Arthur Rhodes used to carry his own can of gas out to the mound.
Oh,
definitely,
man.
Yankee Stadium in playoff games. And notice he was always, you guys always got him on playoff, like he was always on the Orioles, or he was always on the Rangers. He was always on a team you guys were playing in the postseason. And then
Joe Nathan, too, is another one.
I think there should be a Yankee bullpen destruction Hall of Fame. Anyway, Big Brother, it's been a pleasure. We'll have you back on because I wanted to talk about some golf, actually, but we ran out of time. And, of course, you'll be joining us in the fall. We'll talk a little college football soon. And then, of course, your itch needs to be scratched because then, of course, we begin college hoops and defense of your national championship with a very different team than you had from last year. New players.
A lot of talent, but young.
Yes. And Hollywood is always glistening. When we come back, we'll wrap the show up. The doctor will have his prescription, and it's about one of his least favorite wrestlers of all time. More Extra Point. Summertime is cold, he is getting old. Yeah, have a beverage, drink something cold. Go, 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 go. Something from the bar. Yeah, I like cold beverage, yeah. I like cold beverage, yeah. I like cold beverage, yeah. Cause I'm feeling kind of buzzy. Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on PlaceToBeNation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on PlaceToBeNation.com.
In Rhode Island and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick. With over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers, and a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Bonehead's also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place Simulation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
On Richard and the Mailman, we talk about life with great enthusiasm, which eventually leads to disillusionment and inevitably hopelessness. But don't worry, there's lots of laughs along the way. So check us out every week or month or whatever on Richer and the Mailman.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net. Alright, Place to Be Nation. About to wrap up episode 11. Place to Be Nation's Extra Point. Don't forget, follow us on Twitter, P2B Extra Point, and of course email us as well, extrapoint@placetobenation.com. Now, Dr. G, tonight on the prescription, I decided I'm just going to piss you off. Because usually this is a little bit of time that we get to talk some wrestling. And it was announced last Monday night on Raw. Of course, John Cena successfully defended his WWE World Heavyweight Championship at Battleground in that four-way. So, John Cena at SummerSlam will face Brock Lesnar, the guy who broke the indomitable Undertaker streak at WrestleMania and then hasn't showed up for 5 months.
Oh, and then we just give him a title shot.
And then he just shows up and it's time to give him a title shot. Doesn't have to wrestle on Superstars, Main Event, house shows. Who needs him at house shows? And he just gets to wander in and get a title shot.
That's going to do great things for morale. I am just so done with this guy. I mean, the guy just comes in whenever he wants, and then they just give it to him. And I just have a real problem with this. I mean, you had him beat Undertaker, and then you don't have him show up for 5 months.
And look, I love Paul Heyman, and Paul Heyman's promos have been good, but I can't believe – and everyone says, well, it's this per diem dates and everything. No, you can easily adjust that. I'm sorry.
Well, or bring him in for events that don't require him to be around. I mean, you're going to give him a title shot. You know what I'm saying? If it's one,
and
thing
he's been a problem in the past. What if he decides, you know, he wins a title and they plan on holding it till he beats somebody at WrestleMania, you know, Roman Reigns or whoever wins the Rumble, and then he starts becoming a problem about it. Well,
I mean, the thing is that you'd be stupid to put the belt on him, because if he's not going to be around to defend it, you got to have your champion around.
Yep.
I'm just so done with the, as a fan, having someone like this that just comes in and comes out whenever he wants. He's a little baby. Wasn't committed to the sport to begin with, or to the whatever, I don't even want to call it sport, I guess.
The industry,
I guess, to begin with. And, you know, yeah, is he a big name? But, you know, you got all these guys busting their asses every week to try to make it to the top, and this guy could just come prancing in and out. Listen, I understand Vince McMahon, all those guys, Triple H, Stephanie, they're millionaires, and they can do whatever they want. They own the company. Who gives two shits what anyone thinks? That's fine. And but the thing is, you do have people that work for you. Your company right now, I mean, you watch some of these shows and you just like, you know, I call it Raw snore, because sometimes I feel like I do nod off on them half the time. And then you're just going to bring this guy prancing in and out. You know what? If he is such a big name and you're like, it's Brock Lesnar, let's put him all in lights, then you need to have him there more. Then if he's supposedly going to help you, your company, then bring him in on Raw and put him in there to gain you some ratings. I don't think personally that he makes a difference either, in their ratings at all. I would say right now your hot guy right now is Dean Ambrose. I mean, I think he's almost kind of shot ahead of Reigns at this point, because they kind of made him that anti-hero.
which I like. Hmm. Now, those are the kind of characters I like.
I like Roman Reigns. I think I like Roman Reigns. I mean, I like Ambrose too.
I think Reigns overall has the chance to have the better career overall. But like right now, I think what they did with Ambrose was really good. But bringing in, you know, back Lesnar to fight Cena. You know, listen, you could say what you want about Cena. You may not like him. You may not like the his character. But the guy busts his ass. And, yep. You know, he'll do whatever is best for business.
They need Punk.
So,
but that's another case altogether. Well, there you go. I like that, huh?
There's your prescription. I can go on. Let me tell you, you want to bring
Bork
me
laser,
on one of
baby.
Your shows? I have things to say.
Bork laser. All right. We'd like to thank Andrew Reich. And my brother Chris Criscolo for joining us. We'll be back in a couple weeks. I think we're going
to
have a special.
We don't have to thank you, do we?
No.
Okay.
Well, yeah. You should always be thanking me. You can go to bed now. Go walk the dog. Our next show, episode 12, in a couple weeks, we may have a special guest. I'm not saying anything, but I've been talking with him, and he said he wasn't able to make it on tonight. He was with his family tonight at a minor league ball game. But there is a strong rumor he may be joining us for episode 12. I'm not saying who it is. But he may be joining us in a couple weeks for episode 12 to talk some sports. So, how about that, huh? Little tease.
Yeah, a little tease. And let's tweet it up, baby.
Tweet it up. P2, the number 2B, P2B extra point. Follow us on Twitter and send us tweet us your questions, comments, trivia. I hope the Hall of Fame talk fires people up. And don't forget.
Maybe they'll put me on a wrestling show or something once in a while.
You want to be on
the tweet that too?
You could be on the main event. I haven't really thought about
it. I am
Dr.
the
G,
main
but...
event. Haven't you learned that?
The heart. Why? Because you did the Shawn Michaels pose in Izod. Is that what it was?
That's right, baby.
No, that was an ugly bunch of fans, though, wasn't it? So I give you an open shot at. No, well, J. Arsenio Diamato is never ugly, but. by the way, nice sneakers last weekend, JAD. All right. For Andrew Reich, Chris Criscolo.
Oh, wait a second. And before you wrap this baby up, what? I have to give a little shout out. Because, you know, I was talking to you this off the air the other day. And I'm like, you know, I always see, you know, because he's always putting in some hard work behind the scenes. He helps promote our show and everything. I have to give some props out to Jason Greenhouse. He's always helping us out. He's always pinging us every once in a while on the messenger, you know, seeing how he can help us out with the show. So I have to give him some props, you know.
Love Greeny.
Greeny does a great job. I appreciate it. I always see his little posts when we post the show.
Yep.
Those things don't go unnoticed. I appreciate all that he does. Yes. So I got to give him a shout out.
All right.
And he's a fellow Yankee fan, too, and a Macho Man fan. So yes, you know what? That's
a Caddyshack fan. Caddyshack fan too. Anyway, every time I post a random random quote. Hey Judge, I had a good line. Hey Moose Rocco, help the Judge find his checkbook. For Andrew Reich and Chris Criscolo and the Doctor, I am Scott Criscolo. You hit the extra point. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks. If possible. And if we arrive safely, baby, you can lay me down. Lay me down. Lay me down. Lay me down. Well, it's the story of the two. Always on the move. They got nothing left to lose except their guns and their wounds. Now they're crossing border sheriffs, posse on their tail. They'd rather die together than be stuck up in a cell. They drank up all the whiskey and they partied every night. Like it could be the last, the bounty said to shoot on sight. So they chased the endless summer, knew it came with the price. They wouldn't stop running till they found a paradise. But the sheriff finally found them with the sight seeing red. So the lovers had to shoot them down and fill them full of lead. They were finally free to find a place to lay their head. And when they finally did, he looked at her and he said, I said, I think that we can stay here, cause I feel our time has come. And we can walk down to the ocean and sit with the rising sun. So unpack your bags this instant, no more running from town to town. And now that we've arrived so safely, baby, you can lay me down. Lay me down. Lay me down.
got nothing left to do, so wipe the dirt off or take your shirt off. And we should go hit the cantina, we got work off. I said it's hot outside, let me go swimming in your eyes. We've been running for a while, want you lay down, make me smile. I could never ask for nothing better than this. It's just tequila and the beach, it's fine, salty when we kiss. I said I think that we can stay here, cause I feel our time has come.